This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 99 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max.
Hi, David. Boy, we have an interesting topic for this episode, something that I've been hoping we would be able to get into, particularly with an expert, for quite some time now.
Yeah, I'm really happy. Our guest tonight actually reached out to us if there was something he'd like to talk about it. You know, you got to be careful, Chris, when you say things like that, because people say things like, yes, you want to come on the show. Max, why don't you introduce our guest?
Gladly. Our guest this episode is Chris Thomas. He's the founder of MultiGP. Now, MultiGP, it's a grassroots racing organization. They have over 30 chapters in the U.S., and their mission is to make FPV drone racing a real sport. So, Chris, welcome to the UAV Digest.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Now, one of the interesting things about you, Chris, is that besides being an entrepreneur, you're also an avid pilot. You fly powered parachutes, drones, of course, also single-engine fixed-wing aircraft. So you're coming at this from the standpoint of having a really good appreciation of aviation and all the implications of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Drone piloting for me is great because I can do things and put the craft at risk in a way that I wouldn't if I were on board.
For sure. All right. Well, David, what do you say we get started and learn something about drone racing?
Is this where I'm supposed to shoot off the starting gun?
Yeah, that's right.
Gentlemen, you have a race. Well, Chris, again, thank you for reaching out to us, because one of the things that, and we were talking a little bit about this earlier in the show, is we want positive aspects for people to, as hobbyists, use drones and be able to fly them and use them and have positive reinforcement to how to properly use them. And this is a great opportunity. So tell us a little bit, how did MultiGP get started?
Well, MultiGP sort of just happened. I ran into a group of local enthusiasts who were flying multi-rotors, not drones. It was very important that I call them multi-rotors as opposed to drones when I met this group. At the time, I was flying a DJI Phantom, which I still love to fly, and shooting video. And what they were flying was much different. It was essentially a plate of carbon fiber that had been cut specifically to hold motors, flight controller, video camera, and transmitter, and they were racing. Now, for me, that was unbelievable. I didn't think of it. I was used to flying my Phantom, which was very easy to fly, and here were these very aggressive, high-performance, small multi-rotors doing things that were just impressive. I would say they were even more agile than the typical radio-controlled helicopters, which were always impressive to me as well.
Well, Chris, let me just ask quickly. When we talk about drone racing or multi-copter racing, maybe people have different ideas in their head as to just exactly what that means. So can you describe, what were these people doing? Were they weren't drag racing? Was there an obstacle course? What was the racing like?
So I came to the first event, and it was being held at an abandoned golf course. There was a group of tents set up, a couple cars parked off to the side. So as I walked up to the group, everyone had their little tuning station as they were working on their multi-rotors, and they had a starting area. So as I walked up, they were starting their first race. Four of the quadcopters were set out on the line. The pilots went back to the pilot area, sat down in their chairs, and put on, some of the guys put on goggles. Some of the guys were using a screen. One of the guys had a towel over his head. I guess he got some sort of performance enhancement from the, you know, being able to see the screen better. And the guy running the race, you know, called it out, called the race 3-2-1 go. And these little nimble multi-rotors took off and were flying through this course underneath and between trees, just a foot, maybe 2 feet off the ground, and they were really moving. It was very impressive.
Were they flying against each other or against the clock?
So they were racing against each other. There was a set number of laps at the course. That course, which you know is called, now we call that course Arsenic because of the poisoned ground from the pollution there.
But oh, gee.
Wow. We on that course, I believe it was a 5-lap race, and so the first person to finish 5 laps would win.
So to go back to David's question, which I kind of derailed us from a little bit, how did that lead to the formation of MultiGP?
Well, it didn't lead directly to the formation of MultiGP. I was hooked the first time I put on the pair of goggles, and I rode inside one of the drones. As a pilot, I love to fly, but I don't like the extreme G's, and I don't like thinking what the extreme G's are going to do to the aircraft that I am inside of. But with the goggles, I was on board. I was flying through the trees in a way that it most people say it's like the part in Star Wars where they're in the speeders and they're flying through the forest.
Ah, yes.
That's
yes.
What it's most like.
Empire Strikes Back indoor scene. Yeah, that's what I was going to bring that up because that's what I was envisioning when you were saying that, Chris.
I was immediately at that point just hooked. I loved it. So I quickly, within the next weekend, became involved with that group and quickly volunteered to be the organizer of the group because the only thing that I wanted to see more of was more racing. And the group that I was with at the time, it was very laid back. They would show up, they would race some, they would hang out, they would talk, which is great, but I like to race. So I became the organizer, and in the process, I learned that there was a lot of headaches in trying to run these types of events. The headaches is what led me to building tools and software and equipment to try to solve just my own personal dilemma of how do I run an event successfully without having the pilot sitting around waiting for me, without having video problems, without having conflict between the different frequencies. There was a lot to try to juggle. And so I developed first a written system that said, okay, you do this, use these cards, follow this, and the race can happen, to the point to where I got it under control. It became manageable for us to have 20, 25 pilots all show up, all race, and not have too many problems.
Yeah, it probably took, a few races in order to kind of arrive at the sort of the final version of this?
Yeah, exactly. And but fortunately, everybody was happy to be a guinea pig because I was doing a lot of the organization, and they liked what was happening. So the organization grew pretty quickly here in Brevard County. And once I got everything worked out on paper, then I started building software that did the same amount of work, because eventually my goal was to return to not only organizing these events, I wanted to also fly in the events. It was easy to solve with many volunteers, but it's hard to get volunteers because everybody in the group wants to fly.
Yeah, yeah. David and I can relate to that in terms of when you're appearing or when you're part of an event, it's almost impossible to do that and also participate in the event. So
yeah.
You don't get out of it what everybody else does.
Exactly. I mean, I loved seeing it build, and I really enjoy watching the races. What's great about the type of racing that we do is we're flying FPV, which stands for first person view.
Right.
So each of the multi-rotors has a camera. It's broadcasting video. You can watch that video feed. So whether or not you're actually flying, it's still fun to spectate. It's a lot of fun to spectate.
Oh, I got to believe it. It probably happens very quickly. I think from the videos that we've seen, these things are reaching some pretty significant speeds at times.
The typical multi-rotor, which we race, runs a three-cell battery, and we'll hit a top speed between 50 and 60 miles per hour.
Wow.
Well, let's talk about, Chris, a little bit about the multi-rotors you're dealing with. These are not like standard DJI Phantoms, or is there a class system? Are people bringing homemade designs? What kind of standards is there?
Sure. So the actual multi-rotor, the most popular multi-rotor that is being used, is what we call a 250 class. 250 stands for the millimeters between the furthest two motors. So if you measure diagonally from motor to motor, what's that distance? The 250 millimeter class, though, is not usually exact. It ranges from about 220 up to about 300 millimeters. So it's a rough size of multi-rotor.
Is there a significant difference in the performance or maneuverability of the multi-rotor given the size of it?
Well, the smaller becomes more agile. However, the larger is able to carry larger propellers, so it can have higher top speeds.
Hmm.
So there's pros and cons to both. We also limit in the different classes the size of propellers, the size of motors, the types of batteries. And so all these things are designed to make the contest really more about the skill of the pilot than it is about the specifications of the multi-rotor.
Hmm. That must be a kind of a delicate balancing act. I mean, I'm thinking of other forms of racing, motor racing, things like that, where people find ways to eke out little advantages by tweaking little things here and there. And I imagine that at least eventually we might see the same thing with multi-rotor racing.
Absolutely. I would say that without a doubt, as this type of sport matures, the specs will become tighter and tighter. Where we are now, the races are almost always determined by skill. So if you had two pilots competing, they were to race, the pilot who wins would also have won if you switched the quadcopters that they're flying.
Interesting.
So it's rare right now that we have a match that is so close that it's the multi-rotor that would make the difference. I mean, that happens occasionally. What happened with us in our group is as it became organized and we started to fly regularly together, the ranking of the group sort of fell into order. You know, we knew who the best couple pilots were, and then the guys that were about in the middle, and then, you know, the beginners, the slower guys in the group.
Hmm.
And we expanded for that so we could find the next city over. How can we find those pilots so we can compete our guys against those guys? And that's how we started to expand.
Oh, interesting.
I do like the I'm going to date myself, the IROC concept. One of my all-time favorite racing was International Race of Champions, or IROC, where it wasn't about the cars, it was about the drivers. Everybody had the same car, and it was all about driving skill. So I like the fact that you sort of leveled the playing field, and it's not about the multi-rotors, but it's about the flying. But let's talk, I guess, a little bit more about being able to do what you do. You said you first started in an abandoned golf course. How hard is it to find some place that can become a, I guess the word would be track?
Yeah, well, to find a place to fly, every area has its own challenges. Florida is easy. There's plenty of land. It's easy to find land. We currently fly at a private 200-acre field. And it's wide open. We have three tracks that we race there. It is a permanent location. You could go and fly there right now if you wanted to. But you compare that to New York. There is a group in New York called FPV Addiction They are a chapter there who some of the guys drive 2 hours to get to the field where they fly because land is a very valuable commodity. It's much more difficult to find a place to fly. What we look for is land, of course. We need some room, not a lot, and we can fly around trees and things like that. So a couple of acres, we can build a course. But more importantly, we want to make sure that access is restricted. We don't want to fly in an area where somebody may be riding their bike or taking a walk, because when you're racing and you're going as fast as you can, the last thing you want to do is run into somebody or hurt somebody.
Sure, Chris, absolutely. And that kind of leads us to the safety issues that we wanted to discuss with you. What are the kinds of issues that come up when you're putting together an event like this that help ensure the safety of, well, the participants, the spectators, and so forth?
Whenever we go to plan an event, the first thing we're going to look at is the location. And so as we're forming these chapters, that's a big part of what we do. We're trying to form a chapter so that way people have an outlet. I think by now anyone listening to the show knows how many people there are who are excited to fly some type of drone.
Sure.
And the same goes for drone racing. So by us forming a chapter and finding somebody willing to do the legwork to find the land, to find a safe place to fly, now we've given an outlet to another area where more people can go and fly. When we're scheduling an event, we have a fairly simple formula that we follow. We set a schedule for when everybody's to be there, when they're to set up. We regulate where and when people can turn on their multi-rotors, mainly because of video conflicts. If each multi-rotor is broadcasting a video signal, and it's just a matter of changing channels. So if two multi-rotors are turned on the exact same channel, neither will have a video signal. And so we have to control that so that way we don't have a situation where someone is flying and then they go out of control.
Right.
But then we also designate specifically what areas you can fly in, what areas you cannot fly in. We have a certain area where if you're piloting a multi-rotor, you must be in this area. This is the area where you must take off. This is the area where you must land. It's probably even a little bit overboard, but it makes it very easy for not only the organizer to regulate what's going on, but every pilot there to know what is allowed and what is not allowed.
And do the pilots take this seriously? I mean, do you have to work to establish your authority, basically, or do these folks who are competing really understand that it's important that there are rules that ensure safety?
Oh, this community is phenomenal. I would say that 95% are bought in. They're there to help. They take it seriously. There has been, a couple of occasions, but for the most part, everyone is definitely on board.
It sounds a little bit like I have a background in radio-controlled aircraft and an Academy of Model Aeronautics kind of model when they have their contests that, radios get locked into a shed unless they're being flown. And it sounds like you're really thinking of the safety standards to put everybody at ease. And getting them written down. So how's your relationship with the FAA?
Well, we don't really have a relationship with the FAA. We've had several conversations with the FAA, but I wouldn't call it a relationship.
Well, that's good. In this case, that's good.
Yeah.
No, so basically it's private property, so they're basically hands off because you're basically civilians flying on private property, correct?
Yeah, and I mean, here is our thought. We keep these multi-rotors at the tree level and below. I mean, we are at an altitude the entire time we are operating them that if an aircraft were to collide with our multi-rotor, they have bigger problems. They are probably about to make an emergency landing in our field. Fortunately for them, we're nearby to help pull them out of the wreckage.
So, okay, it's Christmas 2015. I got a multi-rotor. Let's use the ubiquitous DJI Phantom. So I can come out and race with you?
Well, you probably aren't going to be able to race your DJI Phantom. Number one, they don't come with FPV equipment. Our pilots are operating these in FPV. So you have to have a video camera that is broadcasting a signal back for you to fly it. Now, if you were to add that equipment to your DJI Phantom and we're running a class that Phantom would fit into, which they fit into quite a few of the classes we race, you're welcome to. But it's sort of like bringing a school bus to race against a Ferrari.
The view might be good, but you're not going to be first across the finish line, right?
If everybody crashes, you'll probably win the race. Yeah.
Well, Chris, maybe give us an idea. You've told us about sort of the characteristics of a purpose-built racer. Maybe give our listeners a little idea of sort of the cost. Now, I'm sure that you could spend ever-increasing amounts of money if you want to, but sort of for a starter, a kind of multi-rotor that people could race effectively, what kind of costs are we talking about?
Sure. There are three major pieces. There are three things you have to buy really to get started. Number one is your craft, the multi-rotor, the drone. That roughly $500. You can buy some of the lower cost parts. You can buy a cloned frame from China and probably buy it for less. But $500 is a good estimate of what the drone itself costs. The big thing to pay attention to is the crash worthiness, because if you're going to race, you're going to crash. And it's important to buy something that is going to stand up well in a crash. I probably have crashed, 100 times, and I'm still flying the same drone.
So you've got probably a pretty good spare parts stock behind it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you really don't break too much. It's amazing how well these things do in a crash. I've had the worst thing that's happened in a crash is I've broke a camera or an arm. A camera costs about $30 to replace. The arm costs $12 to replace. So it's a pretty inexpensive thing to race. You know, if you look at car racing, you're buying tires, you're replacing things you damage. It's a very affordable way to race.
Okay, so you said that the sort of the basic multi-rotor quadcopter is around $500. Does that include the first-person view equipment?
$500 is a good estimate with the camera and the transmitter.
Okay.
What it wouldn't include would be however you decide to view the video feed. Either a set of goggles or a screen. You can go as low as about $100 for that setup and as much as $1,000, just depending on the quality that you want. The average pilot spends about $300 to $400 on their goggles that they use to fly.
And then what else are we looking at? A transmitter, probably?
The last part is the transmitter. Yeah, how you're going to control the multi-rotor. And that can range anywhere from about $150 to thousands of dollars. The nice part is both your FPV goggles and your transmitter can work on more than one multi-rotor. So you could have a couple different multi-rotors, and you're only having to buy the multi-rotor and not an extra set of goggles or an extra transmitter.
Okay, Max, I guess we better start practicing, but I don't think my little Aztec bouncing around the house and and your quad outside is going to get it be up to snuff.
No, a Blade Nano, I think, is probably not what's necessary for competitive racing. Chris, I was going to ask you, what are the prizes like? Is it just the glory of the win? Is there trophies? What are prizes typically like for this kind of racing?
Well, for most pilots, first and foremost, it's about winning, and it's about being faster than the other pilots. But we see, depending on the size of the event and the popularity of the event, anywhere from just the honor of winning up to winning a drone, winning batteries, winning shirts. Recently, there's a contest in California where they've announced a $10,000 cash prize for the winner.
Wow. So they must have some serious sponsorship.
Yeah, it's a pretty big production, and it's exciting. We'll be there.
Great.
Where exactly Can you give us a brief outline? You've mentioned Florida, which is your home base, but where else here in the United States? And then let's talk a little bit about where do you see this going internationally?
Sure. Well, you know, one thing before I go there that we probably should mention is there is a, something that makes this a little bit different. Not only do you build mechanically your multirotor, there's also a whole tuning aspect. There's an equation that tells the flight controller how to control each motor. And so every pilot has a different strategy for how they tune their quadcopter.
Mm.
And that's another aspect to our racing. You could have two identically built machines, but tuned by two different people, and that function in two different ways.
Mm.
But the, back to your question, areas where you can fly now, we have been working very hard. And what we do at MultiGP is a grassroots organization. We're focused on helping other people to establish racing in their area. We do it for free. We're not charging anybody for our services. We just love it and want to see this sport done and done safely. So right now, outside of Florida, if you follow the Gulf of Mexico over to Texas, there's several chapters there. Every big city in Texas has a chapter. All the way up the East Coast, we've got a chapter as far north as Connecticut, I think.
Hey, Max.
We'll have to check that out.
In the middle of the U.S., it's, you know, here and there you'll find a chapter. Today we were setting someone up in Kansas City, and then as you go over to the west, there's some groups in Arizona. There's a group in Las Vegas. There's some groups in California. And all the chapters are listed, and they typically will post their events on our site on MultiGP.
Tell our listeners where they can find that MultiGP site and maybe any other resources that might be useful for someone who's thinking about getting into this.
Sure. Well, our website is MultiGP, so that stands for Multirotor Grand Prix. MultiGP.com. You can also find us under MultiGP on Facebook. There is a very strong community on Facebook and Google Plus for multirotors. So those are probably the best places to start. There's also RC Groups, which is a very popular forum that has a lot of information, and another one called FPV Labs, which stands for First Person View Labs.
Hmm.
Both of those are very popular resources for FPV.
All right, good. And, of course, we'll put all of those links in the show notes so you can find those easily. Well, Chris, we want to thank you so much. This has been a fast half hour, I think, but a fascinating conversation. This is something I think that would probably appeal to a lot of people, either as a contestant or as a spectator. Very exciting stuff. I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the show.
Absolutely. And yeah, definitely. The spectators are more than welcome. We find that at a typical race, we have about 5 spectators for every 1 pilot.
Huh. Yeah, I'm not surprised at all. All right, David, what do you think? Sounds exciting, huh?
I'm glad, Chris, you did reach out to us. Anything we can do to promote UAVs in a positive light, and this is exciting and fun, and the camaraderie, I having been in model clubs and that kind of thing, I know what it's like to be able to spend all day flying like that and then going out and having a couple of adult beverages at the end of the day to celebrate or commiserate, depending upon what happened. But it's a really good opportunity. And tell us, you'll keep us posted and keep us coming back when you've got new and exciting events.
Absolutely.
All right, great. Well, I think, David, that'll about do it for this episode of the UAV Digest.
Should we also say that there are a couple of videos of the weeks for this episode?
I forgot the videos of the week. Go ahead, David.
So Chris has sent us a couple of videos for the week of them doing what they're doing, a first place in view in drone racing, and we'll put them in links in the show notes. They're really cool, and like Chris said, it's really exciting to watch, kind of dizzying, but you want to crank up your speakers and make sure you got the biggest screen because it's really cool. So we'll have those in links in the show notes.
All right, very good. So we want to thank all of you for listening to the UAV Digest. You've been listening to episode 99. Gee, David, one more week and we'll be at that big milestone 100.
Yeah, I don't know what we're going to do about that.
We're so busy. I'm not sure we'll have time to plan anything exciting, but it will be exciting in any event. You can find show notes for this episode at the uavdigest.com/99. Again, we want to thank Chris Thomas, our guest from MultiGP. David, where can everybody find us in the social media?
You can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, on Facebook at facebook.com/theUAVDigest. And if you want to help us and sponsor us, you can leave us feedback and write us at feedback@theUAVDigest.com. If you love the show, leave a review at iTunes so other people can find us. And or visit our website, theuavdigest.com, and look at purchase our swag, or if you'd like, make a contribution via Patreon so that you can help sponsor the show and keep our little endeavor going so we can bring more exciting things like this. When Max and I set out almost 100 episodes ago, we wanted to bring out the positives, you know, in this, and this is a really cool aspect that we want. Well, we'll continue with Chris, follow up with Chris to see what else happens, and hopefully Max and I will get a first-person view out in the field to see these events. So with that, I guess I'll say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.